This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live.
Okay, I think I'm supposed to speak in this bit. Hello, welcome to Teachers Talk Radio with me, Jane Manzoni. I'm broadcasting live from London on this sunny-ish afternoon. Thanks for joining me on the show today. Can you hear me? Yes, so Tom said yes.
Is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live. Tune in live at ttradio.org, or to join in the conversation, download the Podbean app and search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio. Tune in, talk it out with Teachers Talk Radio.
Hi, I've just got my first message, so I think you can hear me. That's great. Okay, welcome to the show today. I've got a fabulous lineup. I've got a colleague of mine, James Hepburn, who's not on Twitter. I've worked with him in two schools before, so he knows me quite well. Great. Do I need to lower my voice, perhaps? Sorry, I'm looking at my screen and I'm realising you can all hear me, so I probably should just get on with what I was saying. I'm going to be talking to James about education in general, about things he might want to change, why he got into teaching, and what motivates him. And I will be asking his opinion on the education conference scene and Edu Twitter, because James is not on Twitter like most of us who will be listening. My second guest is Atlanta Plowden. I'm going to be asking her about her famous surname. And I've met Atlanta at a couple of education conferences. I met her last Saturday at Research Ed. So she said she wanted to be a guest, so I've put her on. And then lastly, I'm going to be joined by Ruth Lusmore, who co-directs New Voices with me. And we'll be talking about Research Ed last Saturday and some of the sessions that she attended, as well as other general chit-chat. So before I get James on, I think I better tell people a little bit about me. Because not all of you will know me from Twitter. I've been teaching for 25 years in the state sector, mainly in Upper Key Stage 2. 16 of my 25 years have been in years 5 and 6. But this year I asked for a change and I got a change. I'm down in reception, which is a completely different world, a culture shock to say the least. My main thing is completely exhausting. Okay, so I'm just looking at the screen to see if I need to say anything. Completely exhausting. I have never been so tired. The things I've learned so far from reception children is that absolutely everything is a teaching point. In Key Stage 2, put your coat on is actually just an annoyance if they take a long time over it. But in EYFS, put your coat on is a teaching point because they can't put their coats on. Sitting in a line, that's a thing they can't do either. If you're an experienced EYFS teacher, I am not one, I expect you've got tape on your carpet or something to make it easier for them. I've got a new carpet, so I tried carpet squares, which they then tidied away. So it does take us a long time to get in a line on the carpet. Eating is something that is a teaching point. I eat with my class, and teaching them how to use a knife and fork is, you know, it's a work in progress. They like to eat their fish fingers with just on the end of their fork and nibble each end of it, or their sausages, not talking with their mouths full because they end up choking. So all of those things are teaching points. Everything in EYFS takes a lot longer. Climbing the stairs, when you've got tiny little legs, it's like Mount Everest. So unless you go super slowly, you can end up losing the end of your line. So going to a music lesson this week, I nearly lost a couple of children, but they did catch up eventually. I thought I would entertain you with a mildly amusing story. You know, when you move into a new classroom and you go into the cupboard to see what the old teacher's left behind. Well, I'm really thorough about that. I like to see every single nook and cranny in case there's some hidden gem. And I did that last week and I found a rocket tent. A tent that was a rocket. So a brilliant thing to find, but I couldn't put it together with the poles. So I just tied it to the ceiling. There was a curtain pole in the ceiling. Yeah, rocket tent. That's from Tom. Yeah, Rocket Temp. It was good. Unfortunately, I didn't put it up properly. So I said to them, these are four-year-olds, don't lean on the side. I mean, if you're 4 years old, don't lean on the side of a rocket tent when you're rolling around. It's just not going to work, is it? Anyway, I was over the other side of the classroom and predictably the tent collapsed upon them. It didn't hurt them, so don't worry. But that was a bit of a hullabaloo. And I guess the moral of the story is only use a tent in EYFS if you put it up properly. Another thing I thought I would whistle on about before I invite James into the studio is how to make great Play-Doh. James saw this lesson, and if you are not a teacher in EYFS, you can still make great Play-Doh, and I would suggest you do it if you've got young children, because it's phenomenal stuff. So you need 3 cups of flour, 1.5 cups of salt, 3 tablespoons of oil, 3 teaspoons of cream of tartar, and about 2 cups of boiling water. And the fun bit is adding the food colouring, the glitter and the smell. So we made green glittery Play-Doh on Friday with peppermint smell. And it was gorgeous and it's all squishy and it lasts a long time. So that's my tip for the week. Make yourself some Play-Doh. Now, I called this show on Twitter EduChat and Cocktails, and I thought I would give you a cocktail recipe a week and link it to an educationalist. So I'm going to do that first, because my first question for James, if you're listening, is going to be, what's your favourite cocktail? So I need to tell you my cocktail first. So I've chosen Long Island iced tea. I don't like Long Island iced teas, to be fair. These are Kathleen, who co-directs New Voices with me. These are her favourite cocktails, and I have no idea why. I really don't know why, because she doesn't drink, and it's a killer cocktail. It is so alcoholic. So to make a Long Island iced tea, you need vanilla vodka, gin, tequila, rum, triple sec, 50 millilitres of all, if you're going to make 4. And if you're on the London Underground at the moment, they say Cointreau, and that's just an orange liqueur, so triple sec or Cointreau, and fresh lime juice, cola, and fresh lime. So you pour the vodka, gin, tequila, rum, and triple sec into a large jug, add your lime to taste, half fill the jug with ice, stir it until the outside feels cold, stir in the cola to combine. I don't like them. I mean, they do the trick if you're out and you want to have a good night. They're very strong, but they taste a bit to me like Panda Cola, if you're as old as me, that very, very cheap cola from the 70s and 80s. Okay, I think I'm going to link that cocktail in a little while. I'm going to link it to my education list. But at the moment, I think I need to go for an advert and ask James to call in, because I've been talking by my estimations now for about 10 minutes. So I'm going to do that and I'm going to ask James to call in. Can you call in, James, please? Let's see if this works.
Creative Resources, made for teachers by teachers. At Creative Resources, we've been rethinking what a classroom can be. We've created a huge range of more than 2,500 original and exciting resources that span across more than 15 different subject areas. Whether you're looking for primary or secondary level resources, careers options, PSHE, arts or humanities, Creative Resources have the resources for you. We offer full curriculum packages and unique challenging escape rooms themed on topics such as Shakespeare, Tudors and fractions. We have quizzes, task cards, Tarsia puzzles and lots more. Better still, more than 100 resources can be accessed for free. Just visit our website www.creative.com. You can get 10% off any order you make on our website by using the discount code TT Radio. creative resources made for teachers by teachers. Every teacher loves stationery, right? Imagine getting a selection of fun, beautiful, and unique stationery items designed and selected especially for teachers, delivered through your door every month. You need to check out teacherslovestationery.club.
I'm always so excited when the box arrives. It's such a treat.
My Teachers Love Stationery Club box is just a little treat to myself every month.
It's always full of delightful and surprising items, including some really good quality stationery brands like Faber-Castell and Stabilo.
And because you never know what you're going to get, it makes it even more fun and special when you get it.
It feels really great to be supporting a family business that's run by real teachers. I can't help feeling like they just know what I'm going to enjoy using stationery-wise better than I do myself.
Visit teacherslovestationery.club and enter the code TTRADIO when you buy your first stationery box to save £2 today. Teacherslovestationery.club.
Hello, James. Are you there?
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Fantastic. I'm presuming everybody who's listening, which is about 18 people. Oh, Andrew Old is listening. Hi, Andrew. I presume you can all hear us. Tom, can you maybe say if it's okay? Yeah, I think so. Okay, James. So I thought I'd ask you, first of all, for your cocktail recipe, because I did tell you at school that's what I would be asking you for.
So yeah, can you... Sure. Yeah. But before I do that, can I just say your Play-Doh recipe, your Play-Doh lesson the other day was a real treat. It was probably my highlight of the week, but it's fast threatening to become my highlight of the year. So excellent lesson. My favorite cocktail was a cocktail I had the other day. It was made by my friend Amy, and it's called a Rainbow Paradise cocktail.
That sounds nice.
Oh, it's excruciatingly sweet, and to be honest, not really normally my taste, but the reason I picked it today was because it reminded me of a primary science lesson. Drinking the cocktails with my friends that day reminded me of sort of being in one of my own science lessons. It's one of those ones where they stack the different ingredients on top of each other. So I think there was some orange juice and some grenadine and some rum, and it was a whole concoction. But it was basically like getting tipsy on a fruit pastel lolly. So very enjoyable.
So hang on a minute, could you see the rainbow in the glass? Did they distinct colours in the
They
shape?
Did, yeah. They stack, you know, that sort of classic primary science lesson where you stack the liquids of different density on top of each other.
Oh, okay.
It was like that, but alcoholic. It was wonderful.
And what's it called?
It's called a Rainbow Paradise cocktail.
Wow, I've never heard of that before.
I think you can do it with different kind of recipes. There was an experiment with Malibu, but that became almost unbearably sweet, but it was good. It was an educational experience, and it was topped off. A friend of mine, she finished off the evening by also introducing a cocktail that changed color. Unfortunately, I can't tell you too much about that. It seems like magic to me, so
okay.
But yeah, it's great.
That sounds really cool. I need to try one of those, and it was called a rainbow paradise
cocktail.
Rainbow Paradise, amazing. And I like the way you linked it to education. You did just what I said. I have to clarify for the listeners that James didn't come into my class. That was at lunchtime. I'd taken my five children into the staff room to make that Play-Doh. That's why you saw my lesson. They were all sitting very quietly, weren't they, and good as gold away from the oven.
Absolutely, yeah. All of the sharp things were put away. It was great. I was tempted to sit down, to be honest, and just join in. It looked fantastic.
Okay, maybe next time, James. Right, so I don't know if I sent you a list of questions because I'm kind of making it up as I go along now. I think I wanted you to say why you got into teaching and kind of the trajectory of your career, because it's quite an unusual one. I suppose not that unusual. Lots of people come in different routes, but you did come in via special ed, didn't you? Came in via Pru.
I did, yeah. It wasn't actually a Pru. I worked in a school that takes children who have the needs that you might find in a Pru. But it was it's an independent therapeutic school, so specialist provision for children with social, emotional, and mental health needs. And that was my way in, really. To be honest, I was just kind of making ends meet as a teaching assistant for a number of years, and enjoyed working in specialist settings. And yeah, it really appealed to me. I moved to London to work in the city, and I wanted to work with, I went, essentially, you know, I was young and I wanted to work on the roughest edges of education. So it was a really great experience for me.
And you then transitioned to state mainstream sets. And what were the main differences that you noticed?
I mean, I think if you go into a school like the one that I started out with, you know, we were very much, I learnt my trade in that school. I was very much raised by wolves in that sense. And going into state mainstream education was an incredibly difficult transition. Just because of the sort of very high expectations and the rigidity of some of the structures that you find in, yeah, and out of necessity that you find in mainstream schools. For someone like me, who's sort of quite, came into it all quite happy-go-lucky and, you know, scraped through my teacher training doing an on-the-job kind of thing, it was a real culture shift and a real change of pace. Having said that, you know, I think that was, it was just a really difficult time the first couple of years. I think I've caught up with the pace now, but it's a very, very different experience.
Yeah, I mean, I know James very well. I've seen him teach lots of times. He's incredibly passionate and enthusiastic about teaching, and has maintained that enthusiasm over the years that I've known him. And I try to be as enthusiastic, but I've been teaching quite a bit longer. I just wanted you to say, you know, maybe inspire the listeners about what you really love about your job, and why you're still in it, because you do have a real passion for teaching every day.
Yeah, well,
I mean, not to be too cliched about it.
I know I'm trying to sort of, I don't want to sound too flowery, but I guess it's all about making a difference, isn't it? And I think that anyone who's listening to a radio show about teaching, you know, none of this will be news to anyone, but it's, you know, it's that kind of, that nice feeling of having and especially with primary, where you've got the one class all year, you know, you've not got different children coming in and out learning one subject like secondary teachers have. It really appeals to me that you kind of take them under your wing for a year and you know, not only teach them all the knowledge and everything, but you're actually, you know, you're there for them and see them through one of them, you know, very formative years of their life, you know, and that's what appeals to me the most, I think.
Yeah, I had a big argument on Twitter. I didn't mean it to be an argument initially. I just said something about the difference between secondary and primary, and highlighted exactly what you said, that, you know, we teach them everything. We really, really get to know them. And you're quite a formative person in their life. Not to say that secondary teachers don't have impact on their children, but they don't have those same children for 5 hours a day. So I think it's a different sensation in the difference you feel you're making in their lives, maybe. I don't know. I don't want to start another argument. Okay. I also wanted to say to you, you're on the outside of this Twitter malarkey, and you have no knowledge of edu celebrities. In fact, I think you think it's quite laughable, don't you? I did drag you along to research. You do. I did drag you along to research, Ed, a few years ago, and you've helped at New Voices. I wanted, you know, for the listeners, not that, you know, we've got hundreds of listeners, but maybe people who listen back. What is it? What do you think of it? Like, is it worthwhile way to spend your time as a teacher? Do you think it's good CPD? Like, a lot of people say that Twitter's the best. That's what loads of people say. It's like the best CPD they've ever had. I'm not sure that I agree with that. But what do you think? I mean, you're not on it.
I mean, I think if, well, I'm sort of a shadow on Twitter. I do read things on it. I think as long as you're discerning I think as long as you're discerning, yeah, I think that it's funny how the most interesting thing about your first guest on the show is that I'm not on Twitter. You know, I do think it's very valuable, but I also think it can be an echo chamber, and I think it can lead to these sort of cyclical arguments between individuals who, you know, perhaps, because of the platform they've been given, and certainly the impression I got with Research Ed was a bunch of very kind of esteemed and intelligent people who had been having the same conversation over and over again and were putting less thought into what they were saying. And there were several really good talks that I saw, but a lot of them were lacking in substance and lacking in the how can I put this without upsetting anyone? It seemed to me that a lot of people were there to talk against things rather than to actually share new ideas and actually contribute something new.
That's really interesting, actually. So, I mean, what is a massive feature of Twitter is this Chad Prog argument, and it centres around, you know, this anti-prog thing, practices that have arisen that might have led to teachers having a big workload and not having a great deal of impact on the children, or children wasting their time not really learning, discovery learning. And when I get to talk about John Dewey, I want people to read him for themselves, because, you know, if you do read Experience in Education, like, knowledge is hugely valued in that writing, and a lot of the things that you would attribute to traditionalism are actually contained in the proper writings of the founding people of progressivism. They value the same things, and I think to get back to what you were saying, yeah, this anti-progressive stuff comes yeah, it comes across really strong, and so maybe that's not so productive. And you, I didn't tell James to say any of that, by the way. It's interesting. No. It's interesting that you noticed that, and I didn't tell you to use the term echo chamber, and I used that recently on Twitter. Although everybody was arguing with me that it is not an echo chamber, but I think, you know, if that's what you
mean, I'm sure there's elements of it that aren't. But I think if you really truly are passionate about something, and you believe it enough to stand and do a talk at a big conference, the best way to do it isn't to speak against the thing that you don't believe in, rather, but actually to speak for the thing that you do. And I think what I saw was a lot of putting down of other people's ideas, and not so much the raising up of these clearly intelligent people's own ideas. I think that was the main thing.
Okay, James, I mean, I know that I could probably talk to you for another 3 hours, because we often do.
If there's cocktails involved.
Yeah, I'm going to have to get you off, because I know that I've asked Atlanta to be my second guest and Ruth to be my third guest, and they're not going to get any chance to say anything at this rate. So maybe I'll invite you on again. Thank you very much. I don't think
I've covered
nearly any half of what I did want to talk about, but yeah, thank you for calling in. I'm going to try and get another advert up now while I decide what I'm actually doing. But Atlanta, if you can call in now, that would be great. Thank you.
Thanks.
Right, where's my advert? There we go.
Need support with your phonics teaching? Did you know Oxford University Press now has 3 DfE validated programs to help you? Read Write Ink Phonics, Floppy's Phonics, and the brand new Essential Letters and Sounds. Essential Letters and Sounds will get all your children reading well, quickly, using phonics books you may already have in your classroom. Developed by the Knowledge Schools Trust English Hub, it's affordable, easy to use, and makes teaching phonics with letters and sounds more effective. Whatever your school's phonics needs, Oxford has the solution. To find out more and receive support from your expert local educational consultant, visit oxfordprimary.com/phonics. Every teacher loves stationery, right? Imagine getting a selection of fun, beautiful, and unique stationery items designed and selected especially for teachers, delivered through your door every month. You need to check out teacherslovestationery.club.
I'm always so excited when the box arrives. It's such a treat.
My Teachers Love Stationery Club box is just a little treat to myself every month.
It's always full of delightful and surprising items, including some really good quality stationery brands like Faber-Castell and Stabilo.
And because you never know what you're going to get, it makes it even more fun and special when you get it.
It feels really great to be supporting a family business that's run by real teachers. I can't help feeling like they just know what I'm going to enjoy using stationery-wise better than I do myself.
Visit teacherslovestationery.club and enter the code TTRadio when you buy your first stationery box to save £2 today. Teacherslovestationery.club.
Hello, I do have to talk again now, don't I? Atlanta, are you? You looked like your mic was blocked.
Am I on?
I think you might be.
Excellent.
Do you have headphones?
Yes, I do have headphones. I'm just going to a quiet bit.
Okay.
Sorry.
I could hear some background noise. Hi, Atlanta. Yeah, I met you last Saturday, didn't I? And you said that we'd met many years ago. And I did vaguely remember, because you're awfully tall, so you're an impressive figure. So, yeah, and you wanted to come on and talk, and that's great. And you've got a famous surname. I thought maybe you could start off, before I ask for your cocktail, explaining your connection to Lady Plowden. If people don't know who she is, she was very, the Plowden Report, I think it was 67, one of the key changes in education towards progressivism, child-centred education. So that's Lady Plowden. What is your connection to her?
She's actually quite a distant relation, I have to say. So my family kind of branched off way, way back. But she's a cousin or something of my grandpa. But interestingly, she did ring my grandparents one day and she was incredibly rude on the phone to them. So not an easy lady.
Okay.
Not an easy lady at all.
But I mean, quite an impressive name to have as a teacher.
Absolutely. More so in primary, though. So I'm a secondary ECT.
That's true. Yeah,
it's
you are.
Not being brought up at all.
So. They probably don't know who she is. Certainly do. Okay. So did you bring along a cocktail recipe for our listeners? So we've had so far a rainbow something. I can't remember what it was now. And Long Island iced tea, which I'm still yet to explain why it's connected to John Dewey. But anyway, go on.
I have got a cocktail called Bad Teacher.
Oh, do explain how to make it.
So my understanding, I've had it once. I was casting my mind back to what cocktails I had related to education. And it's got vodka. So 50 milliliters of vodka, 10 milliliters of sugar syrup, a little bit of lemon juice, 20 milliliters of apple juice, and then a few apple slices and a little bit of cardamom.
I suppose apple bad teacher to apple for your teacher. I can see that.
Absolutely.
Mean, if you substituted the apple for ginger beer, it's practically a Moscow mule.
Absolutely.
I like a Moscow mule, so maybe that's what that was. Great. Thank you. And you've connected it really well to education. So obviously this is going to work. let's maybe talk a little bit about education now. So why did you get into teaching? What made you want to be a teacher?
I suppose a really big reason I got into education is actually because my own school experience was quite colourful. I was excluded a few times at school, had a big, big issue of authority. And I promised myself my entire life at that time I was like, I am not ever stepping in a school again. And then as soon as I got to uni, I was like, I think I want to be back in a school again. So it took me a while to get actually into teaching. I worked at a couple of schools, went off into education research for a bit, but then I was like, no, actually I want to teach. I want to be a secondary teacher, because actually ultimately I find it really fun. If anything, I think it's really good fun.
If you don't mind me asking, what was it that you personally found difficult when you were a student? I mean, I had periods of my school life when I was an ideal student, and I loved school and I loved education. I was doing really well. And periods where I was quite awkward myself. I didn't get excluded or anything, but I challenged authority. I wonder, what was it that you didn't, and that was in schools that were kind of super strict and really liked, I was at one school briefly because we moved around a lot when I was younger, and it really had a great reputation and set a lot of store by its rules. It wasn't particularly child-centered, if you like, and I found that school very difficult, and then I moved away. What was it for you that you didn't like?
Well, it was interesting because I was in a very kind of middle class school that was all very kind of focused on the well-being of the students, really. And it was a really nice school, really, to send your child to. But I think for me, one, it was a lot of boredom.
Oh, yeah. I found school quite boring at times.
I find it incredibly hard to engage with. And I just feel like I was tricky, I was complicated. And when many people actually ask me, what was it? And the only thing I can tell them is boredom. I'm sure there are layers and layers I've not really gone through. But no, absolutely, it was boredom, and it was, you know, hypersensitivity to teacher comments, and just being one of those tricky teenagers that when you have them in your classroom, you're like, okay, this is how I'm going to have to work. Someone I'm going to have to work with over the course of the years. There's no quick fix. So that must have
Influenced how you are in the classroom.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I'm quite good, I would say, at taking kids as they come. And I'm always that one who walks into the staff room. Everyone's like, I've had an awful lesson. They said this to me. How was your lesson, Atlanta? And I'm always quite stoic. I'm like, they were fine. Yeah, a couple of difficult ones, but nothing I'm going to stress out too much about. Because I think it gives me quite a particular perspective. And doesn't mean I can cope with all the behaviour issues that pop up, but it definitely gives me a chance to really kind of reflect and be like, okay, this isn't as bad. This is not, they're not being personal to me. This is just how this kid comes.
Yeah, I think that's the main thing, isn't it? You must understand in a classroom that it isn't personal, that child's going through.
And that's not to say I'm lowering expectations. I'm absolutely, you know, I stick to my expectations. I make it clear at the beginning of the lesson, you know, what I expect and what I want for them. But, you know, I think having that perspective does not mean I'm any less respectful of the school systems or my own expectations. It just means, you know, I save a bit of my own sanity as well.
Yeah. No, I get that. I mean, I always say, you know, in any class, the students that are posing the most problem for you, you know, might be actively acting out or disruptive. Those are the children you've got to work the hardest to really like and get to know, you know, otherwise you're just never going to be able to teach them anything.
It's part of your job. It's part of the job. And lots of people say, you know, if I've ever had a tricky student in my training year last year, they'll be like, you don't have to put up with that. And I'm like, no, I do. It's part of my job. You have to take them as they come, and you just have to work with it and see where you get with it, really.
Yeah, I'm with you. I do sometimes with the uber strict no excuses. I wonder how much they really believe that, because when you talk to people within those systems, in these no excuses schools, when you talk to the actual teachers, I've met a few of them at conferences, they do realise they have to get to know each one of their students, and they don't have a particularly different philosophy to us. But in a way, it sounds like no excuses. You don't really get to know them and make allowances for certain things that are going on in their life. So
you know, I feel what's super important in any classroom setting is you need room for professional judgment. And I trained in a kind of almost no excuses school, kind of at the beginning of its journey. And, you know, that typical where you see SLT doing something that isn't on their mantra and everyone has their little moan. Well, actually, what I saw them doing was using their professional judgment and knowing that actually within their systems, which did ultimately work in the school in the context of Edmonton, North London, but actually they did need their room for professional judgment. They did need to build those relationships in small ways. Otherwise, if they didn't, they would have a problem on their hands.
Yeah, I'm so with you. And I think it gives the wrong impression maybe of the no excuse school. When you see the videos, I watched one for one of these big academy chains that are famous for no excuses, and it was so robotic. And I'm like, it can't possibly be like that in the school. And if you trained in one, I mean, I've never worked in a secondary school, certainly not in one of those types of secondary schools. And I just can't believe it can be like that, because you need to make allowances. There has to be professional judgment. Things do not go to plan every second of the day, and unless you can exercise your judgment and make allowances for certain things, it just won't work. You won't build any relationships. You'll just destroy them around you. Okay, I did want to move on to talk about conferences, because you attend them, and you were at the same one as me last weekend. What sessions did you choose to go to at Research Ed? Who did you go to, and what did you take away from it?
Well, it's a real shame, because I wanted to go to the Powerful Knowledge one with Mark Enser, because I've worked a lot with Michael Young, and we've worked together, and we always have chats about Powerful Knowledge. So it's always good to see kind of other teachers actually tackling the issue. But, you know, COVID rules, so I didn't get to go into the classroom. But I went to a really interesting one by Clive Hill. Got the right name. So I'm not up to date with my kind of education, edu-Twitter people. But I found that was actually a really good session because it was very much, you're an ECT, give a lot and you'll get a lot. Don't let yourself get swept up into thinking too much about the what ifs and all the kind of stuff surrounding edu-Twitter as well. Because I think it's super important with those conferences, you again have to go in perspective. And you know, maybe I'll get some bite back for this, but it's really super clear to me as a trainee teacher that it's really quite hard to be involved in those conferences if you don't know the right people. And it's also quite hard as a trainee teacher to sometimes look through edu-Twitter and listen to conversations at conferences that actually kind of where you see these cliques and this kind of all this arguing, and you're like, do you really want me as a trainee teacher to see that?
So that's interesting, because James said a similar thing.
Yeah.
About, you know, like it's like an argument rather than a conversation.
It can be. And I think there's plenty of really interesting stuff that happens at conferences and on edu-Twitter. Absolutely. And I think it really has its place. But I've seen things as well where, would you say that in front of your trainee teacher that you're mentoring? Absolutely not. So why say it publicly on Twitter? Mm-hmm. So I find the conferences and the Twitter, which I think go hand in hand, an interesting but actually quite a difficult place.
They do go hand in hand, don't they? And I think I'll talk to Ruth about this some more. You know, the main point of, I don't know how much we've achieved this, to be honest, because most of our speakers have some connection to Twitter, was to sort of take it outside of Twitter and open it up. But then, of course, you become more regional. It's like Teach Meets or whatever that used to be before, and you want a bigger platform. So in that way, you have to connect it to social media in some way. So I think it's kind of drawing in people through people who might have a friend who's on Twitter or whatever, and getting the conversation a bit wider that way.
Edgy celebs, I don't understand that. I don't get it. I don't want to understand it. I want to take best practice. I want to learn, but I do not want to, you know, be involved in a community that I feel is not always doing the right thing by the people coming into the profession or even the people leaving the profession. So, you know, it has its pros and its cons like anything, but I like to go to these conferences because I like to find out what people are thinking and how they're applying it. And I wish sometimes Twitter would reflect the same thing.
Yeah, but like you said, there are these big celebrities who then everybody goes to see. You know, like you can't get away from it. Their rooms are the ones that are packed. You know, they're the ones that people do go to listen to just because they're famous. I think maybe the cult of celebrity in general. You know, there is a cult of celebrity, isn't there, in society that anyone who's been on TV or who's got loads of followers on Instagram or what have you, they're somehow worth going to see, even if what they've got to say isn't particularly interesting, just by virtue.
I do have a question, and you may be able to answer this, or a listener, and this is a purely innocent question, but what is Badger Ed on Twitter? What is it? Can someone just please explain it to me? I heard it at the conference. I heard someone saying it at the conference that there
are
badgers in that room. And I'm just interested.
It's an enigma.
No offence, nothing. I just want to know.
It's an enigma. Yeah, no, I don't know what it is. I've got two of the main people who are badgered speaking at New Voices. So maybe I'll grill them some more. I think it's something to do with people who don't want to be involved in the trad prog arguments and want to be outside it, but I'm not 100% sure because I'm certainly not a badger. But I was going to make little badger icons and give them out at New Voices just so anybody who wants to be a badger can be a badger. I mean, we'll ask Tabitha. I think Tabitha's Queen Badger. So, and I think she has been asked this before. She's been asked this before on her show, and I kind of listened to a bit of it. I think it was annoying people on Twitter because I saw a couple of little snarky comments about I've muted Badgerhead now, which I just made me laugh. I thought that if it's annoying people, then it's probably quite cool. Anyway, right. I'm probably going to put on. Did I put on the news before? I can't even remember now, Tom. I think I have to put on another advert now and get Ruth in because we've been chatting for quite some time. But thank you so much for calling in.
Really enjoyed it. Thanks.
Yeah, great. Let me see if I can find, was it the advert or was it the news? I'm going to put the news on. Okay.
This is Teachers Talk Radio. And this is Teachers Talk Radio News.
A report by BBC Newsround highlights the fact that two UK teachers are shortlisted for the final 50 for the World's Best Teacher Award. Both teachers work in schools in England. Kat Ferguson is a critical thinking teacher at Sevenoaks School in Kent, and David Swanston is a teacher of the visually impaired at St Vincent's School in Liverpool. The competition has attracted more than 8,000 applications from 121 countries. Ms Davison has been praised by the school's head teacher for her work inspiring young people to play an active role supporting charities and creating a better world. Mr Swanston, who is deputy principal at St Vincent's, said he was proud to be shortlisted amongst many inspiring teachers, but that the recognition for the school, including students, staff and the wider community, was also important. The winner of the award wins $1 million, which is around £750,000. 10 finalists will be chosen in October, with the winner announced in November. Conservative MPs have called for careers advice to be offered to all pupils from Year 7 to Year 13 in schools in England. MP for Workington, Mark Jenkinson, says this is needed if the government is serious about levelling up, according to a report in the Evening Standard. Introducing his Education Careers Guidance in Schools Bill, Mr Jenkinson said it would simplify the current law and create a level playing field across academies and state-funded schools. The bill will go to a second reading after being unopposed. Mr Jenkinson spoke about the stark disadvantages faced by many young people and that careers advice is one of the most important weapons against disadvantage. At present, the statutory duty to provide careers guidance applies to maintained schools, special schools and pupil referral units, but not academies. Although many academies do have contractual obligations to provide careers advice via their funding agreements. Labour's Shadow Education Minister Peter Kyle said the bill was a vital way to expose children to alternative options to work with those surrounding them when growing up. Ofsted Chief Inspectors and the Prisons Inspectorate have written a joint commentary discussing the impact of COVID-19 on prison education and have announced the launch of a new prison education review. According to details published on the Ofsted website, the findings highlight the significant impact the pandemic has had on prison education, although it also acknowledges that quality of provision was already poor. A series of recommendations includes advice to prison leaders to ensure assessments are used effectively, vocational training opportunities are provided, and learners should be back in the classroom as quickly as possible. This has been your weekend news.
Hi, Ruth. Are you there?
Hi, Jane. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. I was just there's so much to do on this app. There's like messages that I don't have a chance to read, and I'd forgotten whether I'd played the news or not. Had I played the news before, Ruth?
No, you hadn't played the news, Jane. I'm Thank so impressed you. With how well you're doing technology because I have met you, and it's not your thing.
Okay.
I mean that in the nicest possible way.
No, it's not my thing. Okay, Ruth, well, thank you for joining me. First of all, what is your cocktail and why have you chosen it?
Well, Jane, I was going to go with something, you know, like literary kind of play on words, To Kill a Mockingbird, all that kind of stuff, Tequila Mockingbird, but I've decided to go with a classic. It's a martini. All right.
Okay, how do you make a martini?
That's the whole point, Jane, because that's how it links to education. Because a martini, right, you can start off, everybody thinks they know. If you ask somebody for a martini and they go and make you a martini without asking you exactly what you want, they've made it wrong. Because with a martini, you've got different options. You're going to go gin or vodka,
I got to go gin. How much vermouth do you want? Do you want it dry or do you want it sweet or do you just want a normal martini? And then you've got, you know, your little decoration bits. So you're going to have olives, you're going to have lemon, you're going to have pearl onions. And I guess that's why I thought a martini is a little bit like education. There's kind of a basic understanding that we all have, but you've got to individualize it to make it work. Do you like my link there?
Yeah, I think that's incredibly clever.
Shall I show you how I make my one though?
I've never had a martini. You would imagine the amount of cocktails I've consumed in a lifetime. Yeah. I would have had a martini, but it just reminds me of like James Bond or something. Yeah. Going in and ordering, I'll have a martini. It sounds like something from 1970. So no, I've never had a martini.
Okay, well, I like mine dry and slightly dirty. So that means I do it 6 parts gin, 1 part vermouth, and then like a couple of teaspoons of, you know, olive brine. I like it shaken, which is not traditionally, you have it stirred. And in fact, James Bond actually had it stirred. It was only until the movies that he had it shaken. But I like it shaken. Yeah. Oh, yes, Jane. And because in the books, he has it stirred. And then I like it with more olives than you would usually get. I always extra olives. So it's slightly salty. It's delicious. It's really good.
Do you know what? I've just remembered, it was a complete lie. I have had a dirty martini. In dirty martinis.
Ooh.
because I was like, oh, I'm in somewhere called Dirty Martinis, I'll have a dirty martini. And it was disgusting. It was salty and had an olive in it and I didn't finish it. So I have actually had a martini.
Well, maybe you need a vodka martini. But yeah, that's my tenuous education link, that everyone has to have it slightly differently.
If you go to Dirty Martinis though, you have to have the chocolate one because that is the most delicious thing ever. Have you had it?
No, that sounds awful to me, you see.
it's so nice. Okay, I guess we better talk about education. First of all, it is Teachers Talk Radio, not cocktail radio. I kind of wish I could play some funky disco. Oh, you've got some feedback there. But you can't because it's Teachers Talk Radio.
Okay,
why did you become a teacher, Ruth?
Oh, gosh. Do you know what? I've been asked this so many times in my life and I actually can't quite remember why I went and did my PGCE. When I was growing up, I definitely wanted to be everything. I wanted to be a nun for a long time. But, yeah, I wanted to be a praying nun. I was quite specific. I thought that would be
fun. Sound of Music. Did that influence you?
Yeah, precisely, Maria. I wanted to be a pilot. I wanted to be a baker. And I guess anything. My mum was a
candlestick maker.
All of it. My mum was a primary school teacher, and that was the one thing I didn't want to do because she was a primary school teacher at the time when they introduced the national curriculum. And I just remember her coming home with like files and files, bookshelves full of files about teaching stuff. And I thought that looked awful. And she was quite stressed. But I ended up working in sales for a while I was doing my degree, and then decided I didn't like making anybody else money. So went and worked as a TA part-time and never looked back. Carried on from
that. Yeah, that's funny. I wanted to be a teacher from a small child, from 10 years old, and never deviated until I'd got my degree, and then I suddenly decided I wanted to work in retail. So I went and worked for a month in Monsoon in Covent Garden, and it was near Christmas, and I remember they had the Christmas tunes on a loop, and one of the tunes had a donkey in it, like a Spanish donkey, but it was a Christmas song, and it seemed absurd, and I had to listen to it 7 or 8 times a day, and I ended up thinking, well I know why I'm going to go back into teaching now, because I can't do this. I think I went slightly insane. I used to hide behind the coat rails and put my head between them. I mean, I'm only like early 20s here, and just cool my head down. Anyway, random story. so you don't really know why you became a teacher.
I can't remember, but it seemed like, especially in primary school, I'm quite enthusiastic about lots of things in life. I like loads of different things, so therefore teaching about loads of different things seemed like a good way of being interested in my work and trying to pass
it. It is very, very varied as a job, isn't it? And like this year, I've gone down from Key Stage 2 to EYFS, and it's a completely different job. It's essentially the same core, You know, the heart's the same, but the day-to-day interactions and what your day is, what you do every minute of your day is so different that, the variety is great. If you get bored easily, the variety of teaching is great. Okay, so I've asked about why you got into teaching. Oh, I didn't ask any of my previous guests this, but I did want to. It was, what would you change? What's going wrong in education at the moment?
Oh, gosh, I could make a list if you like, but let's try and be specific. So for me, I think one of the things that's going wrong at the moment is we don't have a cohesive understanding of our aims of education as a profession or as a society. I think that's one of my issues with education.
I agree with you.
Thank you, Jane. But I think it starts from that point that until we all have a, it doesn't necessarily mean everyone has to agree, but at least a cohesive understanding of what our purpose is as a group, whether that's primary or secondary or early years or higher education as well, and that journey around education throughout life, not just getting you up until university, but beyond, and how we can make that fit our kind of goals and values of society, then I think we're getting a bit stuck.
I'm just going to link now seamlessly to John Dewey, because he was my link to the Long Island iced tea at the very beginning of the show, because he was born in Vermont, and Vermont's not a million miles away from New York and Long Island. And he said that there, you were talking about the aims of education, weren't you? And I think that it's got completely lost. And when you go back to somebody like John Dewey, it's just there, like in a few sentences, things that we've forgotten. And I wanted to read this out to the listeners. He said, "I take it that the fundamental unity of the new philosophy is found in the idea there is an intimate and necessary relation between the processes of actual experience and education. I assume that amid all the uncertainties, there is one permanent frame of reference, namely the organic connection between education and personal experience." And he says the primary responsibility of educators is that they're not only aware of the general principle of the shaping of the experience by environing conditions, but they also recognise in the concrete what surroundings are conducive to having experience that lead to growth. Above all, they should know how to utilise the surroundings, physical and social, that exist, so as to extract from them all they have to contribute to building up experiences that are worthwhile. So I think Summer Hill is used as like an example of, you know, what he's saying that he didn't want to happen with progressive education. But the experience is essential to it. And then the knowledge crew have come along and said, no, you know, the thing of filling the pail is a caricature, but it's kind of true, isn't it? It's like progressives are saying you have to understand who the child is and the experience of education, what's going on. And that's what we're moving away from. And it's just not defined anymore, is it? Whereas when progressive was in the ascendancy, it was a little bit, I don't know, it seemed more clear to me that what education was for. Did that make any sense?
It did make sense. I mean, I haven't obviously done my revision on Dewey before coming on here, Jane.
No, I want people to read him.
No, you don't.
Okay. The whole point was I wanted people to read the actual book rather than, you know, all of the arguments against the things that have come from progressive education and not actually what it was meant to be. What it was meant to be was linking you to your education, so it's meaningful.
So, I mean, recently, so last summer, I co-wrote a book with somebody about learning for the post-pandemic world. And we looked at, so if we were going to start afresh, we've had this big crisis at the moment. What do we want from education moving forward? What do we want from society? And I didn't look into Dewey in much detail, but we actually went back, you know, to the ancient Greeks and kind of did an overview of everything, touching on places like Summer Hill and why, you know, that kind of went wrong. Because as you say, it wasn't quite what was meant in
It wasn't at all what was meant. That knowledge was so huge. If you read Chewy, he's valuing knowledge all the way through it. It's not let kids do what they want.
No, absolutely not. But I think from my point of view, what I see is I see a system which is, say, for example, everyone talks about education being the key thing to social mobility, that this is a way for people who are in poverty to work their way out. You know, this is how they're going to get out of those systems. We need them to get these grades, because if they don't get these grades, they won't get to university. If they get to university, they won't earn £10,000 more than people who don't have a degree, all that kind of jazz. I just pulled that number out of a hat, but there is some statistic around that. Whereas it seems very much now education is really linked to the economic success of our country. What we measure our education by is this kind of ladder of wealth and moving up the ladder. But if everybody's moving up the ladder, there's still somebody down the bottom. So for me, that kind of thing doesn't work. But like you say, more the developing of a rounded human being, one where we're looking at not just competencies, you know, are they competent in their skills, in their reading, in their arithmetic, all the things that are very helpful in life. But what values do they have? How are they going to live their life? Are they going to be individualistic and looking at getting the best of them? Or are they going to be community focused? Now, for me, my values, and I come from a particular Catholic upbringing. We were talking about this over lunch, actually, the other day. We were talking about the idea of life.
We were, weren't we?
We were, life in all its fullness. We talked about that.
I had an epiphany, didn't I, over lunch? It might have been wine.
It might have been the one. But we talked about the idea, which I've been working in Church of England schools recently, and they talk about life in all its fullness. And, you know, seeing that as a core purpose of education is we want people throughout their life to live life in all its fullness. That's not, you know, getting what you want all the time. It's not about being, you know, individualistic. But really experiencing and enjoying life and getting lots from it, rather than being, I don't know, I just feel like things are a bit twisted at the moment and we're not there.
I absolutely agree with this. It's not just about exam grades, you know, and unless you have thought in depth about what you're doing there, what is education and what is it for, and that's what drives you every day within the classroom. And as a professional, as every individual teacher, you've thought about that, and you know, I don't see how you can call it teaching, really.
Do you know what? I remember when I was doing my A-levels, I studied many of the, you know, the humanities. I did English literature, I did theatre studies, did classics and all of that, and history. And my theatre studies teacher had managed to get us a masterclass with Alan Rickman, the actor. And the English teacher stopped her from taking us because we were 2 months away from our A-level exams. And it was for an afternoon. And you just think, like, I've never really got over that.
Like, deprived you of something.
She deprived me of something an experience like no other, that was there on the table. It was a one-off thing. Something else had been cancelled. And he was able to do it. And that was an experience that would have stayed with me for life.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, none of us were failing our A-levels. We were all doing fine. So did we need another afternoon school? No. I wanted to go see Alan Rickman. So I think, you know, it was one of your earlier callers was talking about professional judgment.
That was Atlanta, who's very interesting, I think.
Making professional judgments, not just in the case of what you think will be measured at the very end points, you know, in exams, but what professional judgment, what's going to be good for those children long term that might not be measurable?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so I think we should move on and talk about research ed that we attended together before we have a chat and plug new voices. So we both went there last Saturday, and you went to we attended Jasmine Lane's talk together, and then you went off to see another one on a similar topic, which I did not attend. And I thought you sounded really enthusiastic about that, and you wanted to talk about that. So I was going to give you the opportunity to say what that was about.
I guess for me, things like the Saturday, the idea of a Saturday conference. So I've given up a Saturday, paid, you know, a substantial amount of money to get there, not just for the ticketing, but also transport and, you know, food and all that kind of jazz. So when you kind of do anything like that, it kind of assess, is there anything that I would be doing differently as a result of it? And it was definitely Megan Dixon and Martin Galway's talk, which was kind of expanding on what Jasmine was saying. Jasmine was talking about the simple view of reading, but they took it and they've been doing some really interesting research about the simple view of reading. So if you don't know about it,
yeah, for the listeners who don't know, perhaps just kind of explain the simple view of reading and how that came out of the reading wars. And
yeah, so the simple view of reading is basically a formula: reading equals decoding multiplied by listening comprehension. You could write it down like that. And when I was a literacy coordinator for a long time, and when I was training and in working with my staff, we'd often view our children on this grid of literacy, of reading, this simple view of reading. So you have going along one line, you know, can they decode, can they not decode? Can they have good kind of listening comprehension skills? Do they not have good listening comprehension skills? And in the top right-hand side, they've got both those things, therefore they're exactly where they should be. And so it's very much a simple view. And this is the point that Martin and Megan were making. It's sometimes these simple things are deceptive, because actually reading is not that simple. We know it's not that
simple. It certainly isn't, no.
No, but you know, the simpler we go in these kind of models for us to think about things, the more easy it is for us to misinterpret it or not really unpick things. So they were talking about how the simple view of reading, it matters a lot because, you know, our phonics policy is based on this, the MPQ, the CEF, the ECF, the IEF. The reading framework is all based on this model, but it's not as well as well understood as it should be. So they were talking about how the fact this simple view of reading came from 1986, and it was published in an SEN journal. So they were thinking about this was actually mainly to be used for children who had some difficulties in reading. But actually, they didn't stop their work there. But it seems that we stopped our listening at that point. We saw that nice little easy graph and then thought, that works. We can all understand that quite quickly. Okay, and then we didn't follow the research, we didn't follow the thinking on. So that's what I found fascinating about it. You know, decoding, it must, I mean, there's so many things, there's complexity.
I'm having fun with phonics at the moment.
Are you?
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're only four, so we know SatPin, we know the sound, but yeah. blending them is really quite complicated. So I'm noticing a lot of at pan.
Yeah.
So completely different.
And I suppose, so this is their point. So decoding at that level, eventually most of those children are going to get it. There's going to be, you know, 10 to 16% of them who probably won't and need a bit more. But they were saying how this simple view of reading forgets things like oracy. How important is oracy in for children to be able to speak, to be able to read, comprehend, to listen? And we don't measure that.
No,
we monitor their phonics ability and we measure their ability to do a test, and we can talk about all that. But essentially their main point was we need much more, much more structured systems of diagnostics for children when they're not doing as well as they should be. So I don't know, did you ever work with a reading recovery teacher?
I did work in a school where there was a reading recovery teacher once. Yeah, and she used to, it was quite intensive what reading recovery teachers do. Yeah, really.
But so what it made me think of, because they were talking, Megan is a secondary school, she's a leader in a trust and she has secondary school. So she was talking about certain assessment at Key Stage 3 that can be used to really unpick what the problems of reading are. But I was thinking about when many, many moons ago, I used to do the assessment for a reading recovery teacher. So I would sit down with the children and they didn't sit and do a test or just read to me once. It would take about 45 minutes for me to screen a child, if not longer.
Was it like a miscue analysis?
Yeah, you start with miscue analysis, but you'd also look at things like, do they understand which way a book goes round? Do they understand print going from left to right? Can they pick out what a capital letter is? Do they know the difference between, you know, the name of that, all those kind of things, which one of my issues at the moment, if I'm thinking about my school, the school I've just finished being ahead of, is in the last couple of years with the pandemic, I haven't had the opportunity to really think and put those things in place. We haven't had the consistency of staff in the building. We haven't had the consistency of children in the building. we're having to reduce our staff all the time due to budget cuts, but we're not going to get any better at reading unless we really increase our knowledge beyond just the teaching of phonics, which I think we've done pretty well.
I think a really interesting recurring theme in reading and what schools get stuck on is that there's a certain level that children in primary schools get to. It's what used to be called 4C. I suppose it's like expected standard now, but maybe, you know, kind of scoring the lower end of what would meet expected standard. And then beyond that, pushing those children to what is greater depth now and used to be level 5 in old money. And several schools, because I've been a literacy coordinator in several schools, they will say, you know, before I've gone in there, I think I've managed to achieve this and I'll tell you how. They've said, like, we're stuck now. We've got a certain percentage of children. They're reading, they're decoding, they're answering the simple inference. How do we get them further? And it's really by quality exposure, overexposure, if you like, to multiple quality texts. And that means in primary school, the teachers reading to them. I mean, I would aim for 2 novels every term at least, you know, and being read aloud to them and talking about the language in it, the archaic language, the idioms, talking about characterization and just really, really understand. Because if children don't read widely by themselves, the only way to get them to be a reader, which is a very, very complicated process, which I think was your main point, wasn't it? Is the way to get them to be that is just by, you have to read to them. You have to read aloud to them with expression, with enthusiasm, and you have to read them good stuff. And when phonics was first becoming compulsory, you know, it's been compulsory for a long time, but, you know, the ascendancy of SSP, those pamphlets the children were learning to read with didn't have any story in them. And it was like, it wasn't that anybody said, oh, you mustn't read like books with multi layers and they weren't really saying that, although one school that I worked in did say it's only these pamphlets, it's nothing else, that's how you're teaching them to read. I don't know what point it is. You have to be aware of all of the parts of reading from the very beginning, that you're teaching these explicitly and you're teaching them with good quality texts.
Absolutely. And I think that's the bit that, you know, jumped out from me listening to them was I have 17 years experience doing literacy stuff and I knew a lot of what they were saying, but it just made me really think, gosh, our model is far too simple. And when we're training people to be teachers, we're kind of skimming over this surface level of knowledge about what we do know about reading. And we're not really skilling up our teachers with the kind of knowledge about how complicated reading is and what it means. And therefore, yeah, like you say, reading stories, but understanding the oracy, understanding oral tradition. And just there's so much in it, which is just
It's life though, isn't it, Ruth? I mean, reading is life. You know, books are life. And that's why English is the subject that I've always been passionate about. And it's the core for me in primary school of any decent curriculum, you know, that you link it, because you can find a novel, you can find a great quality novel with all of the social issues that you want in the historical period that you want, you know, and then you can draw that out of it. And then it will link in some way to the child's experience. And that's, you know, progressive education, if you like, at its core. It's making those connections with the child and the knowledge of the wider world, so they're learning through it.
I think
on that note,
another interesting point they were talking about was the idea of active self-regulation, that you, in order to be able to read well, you need to be kind of regulating yourself to want to be able to read at that point in time. Do you know what I mean? Like, we kind of ignore all those bits and pieces, don't we? We ignore, we're like, can they decode this? What score did they get on their reading test? Oh, they're a reader or they're not. Oh, it's too simple. Things aren't that simple.
Okay, should we have a little bit of a chat about new voices and why we're excited about it this year?
Well,
so we've got a great lineup of different people.
But maybe, James, should you explain why new voices came about?
Maybe I should. Yeah. So it was 2018 and we'd been whinging. I think lots of people, I think including Andrew Old, who happens to be listening in, had been saying that there wasn't enough teacher representation at conferences, that it was all, I think his beef was it was all people who were selling stuff, I guess. Maybe he'll put me right, because if he's listening, he can just type something there. I think because we nearly started a conference together. I think it lasted literally like a day and a half. We were sending messages that we wanted like teachers to be speaking. And it wasn't at that time. So, and we, it was like a lot of the same people, wasn't it? I made a joke, I think at 2019 conference, saying the Edu lads on tour, but it was like that. It was like, you know, there were six men, they were, and they were at every single conference, every single conference I went to, and they got all of the people went to see them, and that's where the Edu celebrities kind of came from, these packed rooms with these people essentially saying the same thing over and over again. And it's not that what they were saying was bad, it was interesting, they're intelligent people, they said it, they presented it in an engaging manner. But surely in a profession with 630,000 people, we listened to James and we listened to Atlanta earlier on in the show. Those are just two teachers teaching. Nobody's really heard them speak. As far as I know, Atlanta hasn't presented. And I know even though I've tried to get James to speak at New Voices, he's still a little bit reluctant to do it. There's so many interesting, competent people out there with things to share that aren't getting a platform at all. And that the conversation is a little bit insular. So yeah, we tried to do that, didn't we? And then you agreed with me, and obviously you're better at organising stuff, so I couldn't have done it without you.
I think
you absolutely are.
I think from my perspective, so I was never part of going to teacher conferences. My background is that I would go to academic conferences around teaching. So I've been to AERA, it's the American Education Research Association, a couple of times over in the States and Canada. And those conferences, Jane, they are huge. I've got in one of my shelf in front of me, it's like a Yellow Pages book of all the different things that are being spoken about in education. And I think sometimes when it's come to my, I'm not really a massive Twitter user, but I do use it a bit, but it seems like the conversation's so narrow at times, I really don't understand how Twitter works. That for me, the idea of getting some other teachers out there and in a supportive environment, because actually sometimes it's pretty hard to put yourself out there and speak, was what really appealed
so
to me.
So frightening. I mean, I did a couple of them, and it's horrible. I mean, it's scary as. I spoke at the Festival of Education down in Wellington. I was petrified, you know. That was, I spoke about Dewey's dream died on a panel, and all I remember was I thought that there'd be a table in front of me, and then there wasn't a table in front of me. My skirt was too short, and then I had Laura McInerney in her yellow jacket looking amazing, and she's so accomplished at speaking. It was just petrifying, awful. So no wonder people don't want to do it, really.
Well, I also think, so for example, while I was listening to your previous speaker, I noticed that somebody had like copied what they said from this conversation and put it on Twitter. That terrifies me.
Really?
Because why? No, I didn't want to be quoted all the time. Sometimes I'm just having a conversation. Do you know what I mean? And actually the whole kind of thing about putting yourself out there and being either misinterpreted, or it happens all the time, doesn't it? And
well, Twitter is classic, isn't it?
It's not very kind, and so I can understand why people are reluctant. So what I hope we've tried to create, or we're looking to create, is a place where it genuinely everybody's new there, so nobody's running off to see the big name, because the big names are in the room listening, and actually everyone's kind of got their back, because they all know this is the first time I've done that. And I think that's
We don't have a speaker's lounge or a green room, do we? Like, we have a kitchen where everybody has a cookie or a piece of cake and a Prosecco. So, I think I like it. I think we've achieved something, although it's quite small in the conference stakes. I think we're doing something completely different.
Hopefully, you know, those people then go on to do other things as well, which is important too.
Well, they do. They have done, haven't they? I mean, of all the read, I'm hoping to interview her, I think, next week. So she's written a really great book that I've read about mindfulness in leadership and how to incorporate the practice of mindfulness into being a good leader, and how you have to recognize your sort of issues with your own parents, because that has a bearing on how you lead a school. So really important. And she spoke at New Voices, and then obviously Cassie Young did, and there's lots of people who've gone on to do things. So yeah, it's great. That's I was going to ask you, Ruth, how's working in the wine shop?
So as none of you would know who I am, I recently finished being a head teacher after 5 years, and before that was a deputy head for 5-6 years, and before that I was a teacher for 10 years. I don't even know anymore, and I'm having a bit of a break. So working in the wine shop is good. It's good. I mean, there's no pension in the same way as the teachers.
It's not like working the monsoon where you have to listen to something on a loop, is it?
Oh no, I did that when I worked in Thorpe Park as a teenager. That was horrendous, and I understand your pain. But no, it's good. I'm learning. I tell you what's interesting is going back into the, I'm air quoting here, but you can't see it, the real world from education, and actually working in a business and seeing what that is like, seeing what the issues are. And I'm hoping that, you know, it's part-time when I'm trying to get my PhD finished. I'm hoping that actually will stay with me when I do eventually get back into schools, remembering what the real world is like, because I do think it's such a bubble, isn't it, in education, we think.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I've been in the bubble so long. I don't know what the real world is like. You know, like I had that.
It
that
doesn't have as good a holidays, Jane.
Is that what it is?
It's rubbish holidays, honestly.
Yeah, but I've got friends who work in the real world. And you know, when I talk to them about their working week, their whole day sometimes is like a couple of meetings and, you know, a trip to the coffee machine whenever they feel like it, and chat with people, you know, our age, or, you know, adults, talking to adults.
I'll tell you what.
And having alcohol at lunchtime.
Oh, the freedom to go to the toilet whenever you want. It's amazing.
I know.
No, it's interesting, and I'm learning a lot, but I am missing.
Are you already?
I am missing.
In a week and a half, Ruth. Anyway, you need to come and volunteer in my reception class. You need to give me some tips.
You'll just find me on the floor playing with them, because that's what you're supposed to do.
That is what I do. That's what I do all day. I'm playing with the small world stuff. A lot. No, actually, I'm doing so many things. I've got, do you know what? I've got these two puppets called Tig and Ollie, I decided to teach numeracy with Tig and Ollie, and Tig doesn't know any of his shapes, so he's playing like this, and he goes, "Hello, triangle," and then the children are screaming, "That's a red circle." And then I've got
classic
Ollie.
Classic Tig.
And I've got Ollie, who goes, "Yes, Tig, the children are right. That's not a yellow triangle."
Are you saying that the people with deep voices have got more knowledge than people with high-pitched voices there, Jane?
And he's an owl.
And he's an owl. Oh, man.
And Tig is a tiger. The thing is, I tried to teach numeracy on Friday without Tig and Ollie. I thought I'd mix it up a bit. And then they screamed for Tig and Ollie. So I'm like, I'm now made a rod for my own back. So, like, any subject is going to have to involve the puppets. But anyway,
gosh.
It's not the real world, is it?
I know, but it's a wonderful world to be in.
It's a wonderful world. I'm really loving it. Okay, well, is there anything I've forgotten? Did I say to you what I was going to talk about, and then I
spoke about all those things? We're all good.
Okay, great. I've got 10 minutes left to fill, and I have no idea what I'm going to talk about, but I'll try and talk about something. I'm going to put on my last. advert. It's my last advert, and then I'll frantically look at my notes and see what I'm going to talk about. Oh, do you know what? I can ask the listeners now if I've got any listeners left.
You have. There's people commenting.
Is that on Twitter? Was it?
On the app, Jane, on the app.
Oh, but I don't have that open. Okay, if anybody has any comments that they would like me to read out, you can do that. Otherwise, no doubt, I will find something to talk about. Okay, thanks,
Ruth. Right, take
care. Bye.
Need support with your phonics teaching? Did you know Oxford University Press now has 3 DfE-validated programmes to help you? Read Write Ink Phonics, Floppy's Phonics, and the brand new Essential Letters and Sounds. Essential Letters and Sounds will get all your children reading well, quickly, using phonics books you may already have in your classroom. Developed by the Knowledge Schools Trust English Hub, it's affordable, easy to use, and makes teaching phonics with letters and sounds more effective. Whatever your school's phonics needs, Oxford has the solution. To find out more and receive support from your expert local educational consultant, visit oxfordprimary.com/phonics.
Hi, so I don't have much to read out apart from Barry telling me Ruth is really interesting, which she is, and somebody telling me I'm doing great. And I have nothing much left to talk about. I mean, I could tell you, yes, she is really interesting, Barry. I could tell you what my actual favourite cocktail is, because I haven't, I told you about a cocktail that isn't my favourite cocktail, but my favourite cocktail is an old fashioned, which is just whiskey. It's whiskey and bitters and burnt orange peel and ice, lots of ice. And the secret to a good old fashioned is obviously in your choice of whiskey. I'm not that fussy really, but a more expensive one is nicer, not like Bell's or something. And then you have to mix it a lot. You have to mix it up a lot and crush the ice. Talk about how teacher tired is really, really more tired than anything. That always makes me laugh. Yeah, but Barry, it's true. I mean, I was so exhausted. I'm eating like a savage. I'm coming home. The other night, I had a pizza with like a handful of gherkins and a handful of jalapenos, and I squeezed some mayonnaise on it, and I didn't even bother cutting it. I just like chomped on it. You know, it's food savagery. That's how tired I am. And then I had baked beans out of a can, I think, also last week. That's just gluttony and not fatigue. Okay. Yeah, maybe it is. I do cook. Like I make bread normally. I make cakes. I make, I use a slow cooker. But no, I'm so tired at the moment that I'm eating awful stuff. I really think I'm going to have to end the show, Tom. So I hope that's not breaking the rules, because I'll get better at keeping to time. Well, if you have been listening live, thank you so much. Thank you very much to James and to Atlanta and to Ruth for helping me fill in an hour and a half. I'm in London School 20th. What's that, Barry? Okay. And I will think about how to structure it better next time. So where's my ending jingle? Let's find it. There we go.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live. This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live. Tune in live at ttradio.org, or to join in the conversation, download the Podbean app and search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio. Tune in, talk it out with Teachers Talk Radio.